This is Asher versus District Court, Cantor G&W Nevada Holding LLP, 67767. Mr. Pulsenberg, on behalf of the petitioners.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Dan Pulsenberg for the petitioner, Joe Asher. Smart business people enter into contracts, and they enter into contracts that lay out their rights and obligations, what would happen in the future, the law that governs, and doing this makes things more predictable, more reliable, more efficient. In fact, this court, in adopting Restatement Section 187 in 1979 in Ferdy Seavers, pointed out that it is just this kind of ability, turning over the ability to of the parties to govern their own lives and their own responsibilities, that has the court allow them, parties are permitted, this court says, within broad limits to choose the law that will govern the validity and effect of their contract. And we say that that principle applies to any choice of law provision, including the statute of limitations. Judge Denton disagreed on two bases. Judge Denton said, first of all, there is a case from 1869, Wilcox versus Williams, that says the forum always applies its own rule. And secondly, he cites a minority position of courts that says even in a choice of law provision, you have to expressly mention the statute of limitations. Let me take Wilcox versus Williams first. I don't think that that case applies to a contractual choice of law provision. It was an entirely different situation. There was no contract there. It was just the question of what statute of limitations does a Nevada court apply. In a contractual context, this court has never expressly talked about Section 187 in the context of the statute of limitations. I don't think Wilcox versus Williams survives Ferdy Seavers and this court's adoption of 187. And I'll go a step further. Last September 24th, Justice Cherry wrote the majority opinion in Mardian, where it points out that in that case, there was a choice of law provision, and so and it chose Nevada law, and so Nevada statute of limitations should apply under the choice of law provision. Admittedly, it didn't talk about Restatement Section 187. But that's what I think this court should clarify right now, that when parties choose the law that governs, that law is all of the law. It includes the statute of limitations.
In Mardian, I think, Mr. Pulsen, wasn't that property was in Arizona, as I recall, and the action was in Nevada?
The action was in Nevada.
Okay, so the question was which statute of limitations applied between the two states.
Exactly.
Okay, so and you're saying you're analogizing that to this particular case as well, that we should apply the Nevada statute of limitations.
No, we should apply the Delaware statute
of limitations
The contract between the parties chose Delaware law to apply. Okay. Now, the courts that rule a different way say that there is a difference here in procedural versus substantive law. And that is where I must insist the majority of courts have moved away from that. There's a separate section of the restatement that applies to non-contractual choice of law for the statute of limitations, and that's section 142. And 142 has gotten away from the substantive versus procedural distinction, and in fact it sets out in its comments that this is based on the majority of cases that have moved away from that distinction, and that makes sense. Because it really doesn't, it's not logical to say that a statute of limitations is procedural as opposed to substantive. It isn't procedural, doesn't govern the rules of the procedure or court administration or even evidence. It affects the substantive ability of one party to recover, and I'll go further and say of one party even to bring the action. And in this way, it's substantive. We set out the cases that talk about the Erie Railroad distinction about whether federal law applies substantive law or procedural law. And that court, all those federal courts have said that statute of limitations are substantive because they affect the right to recover. Even this court, and I set this out in my supplemental authorities, in looking at choice of law, looking at substantive versus procedural distinction, now uses the same Erie standards. So it really is an antiquated notion that a court would automatically apply its own statute of limitations. But I'm not arguing that the court has to go that far. Only when there's a contractual provision should this court apply the law chosen by the parties. The other side has brought up latches and says, well, no, we've waited too long. They say we waited 2 years from the time that we raised this issue in the district court. Well, it wasn't really 2 years. It was about a little more than a year and a half. But to show latches, you need to show three things to prevent a writ petition. You need to show an inexcusable delay. You need to show a waiver, an implied waiver out of acquiescence, and you need to show undue prejudice to the opposing party. Let me address each of those, although the last two are interrelated. There wasn't an inexcusable delay here, because what we did, now they say, the reason we ran this writ petition is because we had lost the legal battle on whether this covenant not to compete was enforceable. Well, to a degree, that's absolutely true. Remember, after we raised the statute of limitations, we raised the legal point that the covenant not to compete that they're raising, which is 4 years, and Joe Asher couldn't compete anywhere in the world, we said that was unreasonable as a matter of law. And Judge Denton rightfully took that up as a preliminary matter before a trial on all the issues. So here was a chance to be able to avoid the statute of limitations issue and just win on other substantive matters.
Did Judge Denton decide that covenant issue as a matter of law, or did he say there was issues of fact involved?
There are issues of fact as to whether we breached it.
Okay. But he said it's a matter of law that 4 years in a worldwide non-compete was okay?
Yeah, which did kind of surprise me. And tell you the truth, I thought about running that issue up in this writ petition as well. But the statute of limitations issue seems to be so much more clear-cut and so much more geared to the type of proceeding this court could have in deciding a question of law. All you have to do is say when the parties choose Delaware law, they choose the statute of limitations. I think that leads right into my waiver issue. They can't claim waiver. I mean, it's not like I've waived the statute of limitations by not bringing the writ petition earlier. In fact, they claim quite the opposite. They're saying I can raise it later after trial on the merits. Well, that doesn't seem to me to make a lot of sense for us to have to go through an entire trial on the merits when the vast majority, the huge bulk of this case, will be resolved on the statute of limitations. And if I have to raise it, if I have to go through the trial and raise it on appeal, I'll be raising it on appeal with all the other issues, including the legal enforceability and scope of a 4-year anywhere in the world covenant not to compete.
So you're in favor of piecemeal litigation?
No, I'm not. But you and I debate a lot of times whether a writ petition makes sense. I think a writ petition makes absolute sense in this case. I heard you in a seminar once talk about how you think the court's mood about writ petitions was tempered by Schutte versus Beezer. And this is rather the same thing. You look at all we've done so far is conduct an evidentiary hearing, which we've called the first phase of trial.
Remember that Justice Ada and I were not members of this court when Schutte was decided.
I know.
When the writ was denied here, and I think that
I know.
My colleagues that were there at the time felt bad that they denied it since Alan Earle had to face a trial from October to February.
And I was at that trial every day except 2 days. So I do know what a burden that trial was. This case is going to be worse.
Mr. Paulsenberg, back to the immediate, though. In other cases, we've looked at 11 months was a waiver in bringing things.
And I've cited a federal case that said 4 years isn't a waiver. I think what you have to do, you realize it's an implied waiver due to an acquiescence. It's not as though we acquiesced in the resolution of this claim. And we didn't acquiesce in the trial of the case. The trial that takes up the factual issues, breach, damages, that's still not even set for trial yet.
And which kind of is the question, why should we even intervene? Why shouldn't we just wait till this is final and then deal with it?
Well, the reason is two reasons. First of all, the subjective issue in this case, we're going to go through an awful lot of litigation. We went through a month-long evidentiary hearing on just the enforceability of the covenant not to compete with 22 so-called pretrial hearings. And secondly, objectively, this is a very important issue. It comes up over and over again. It's an issue of statewide importance. The federal court addressed, I bring out three district court cases, federal district court cases that raise this issue in my petition. I missed one that came up 2 weeks before my petition and one that came up since my petition. This issue keeps coming up in the state and federal courts. And it's an important issue, and that's really the reason why we focused the writ petition on this important statewide issue rather than also including the more complicated enforceability issue.
So I guess you're surprised that you're before three of us instead of seven of us, that this should have been en banc.
I think it should have been en banc. I didn't bother to ask for that. I mean, if you look at the restatement and the application of it, I mean, I think that there are other justices on the en banc court who have also wrestled with the idea of the restatement and how it applies both in statute of limitations and in contracts. This court has had a real evolution in the statute of limitations and choice of law. We've seen that in General Motors. We've seen it in Northwest Pipe. I think it's an important issue that needs to be brought up.
We can still transfer it en banc. You would recommend that we do that?
Oh, I definitely would do that. Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to save my remaining 3 minutes almost for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Bice.
And while you're coming up, Mr. Bice, would you comment on Justice Douglas's question about should we intervene at all at this time?
Yes. May it please the Court, Todd Bice on behalf of the real party and interests here. The answer to the question is, should the Court be intervening at this point in time? The answer is no, which is why I originally moved to dismiss this petition, that it shouldn't even be considered by this Court. And let me tell you why. The underlying trial of this action would have been done by now, and this case would have been up on an ordinary appeal. And if this party was aggrieved, then this question would have ultimately reached this court. But contrary to the assertions made, we held a month-long trial. The trial was bifurcated. This was no evidentiary hearing. This was a month-long trial in front of Judge Denton, sitting as the decider of fact, which he did. We held more than a dozen witnesses. I'll get to where all those witnesses are from, and we'll talk about which law applies in just a moment. But the point being, the only reason that this case isn't done is because they moved and asked this court to stay the case, stay the second phase of trial, while this writ petition was ongoing. This case would have been over with, done with, and we could have had one appeal, assuming that they were still aggrieved that they lost the second phase of trial, and we could get finality on all these issues. But now, because of this, they lost the first phase of trial. They want to do it piecemeal and have effectively frozen my client's rights to enforce the agreement. And let me deal with this assertion that somehow Judge Denton enforced a 4-year non-compete on a worldwide basis. Not true. What Judge Denton actually ruled, and he has a 64-page finding of fact and conclusions of law about the double cross that was committed against my clients by a former lawyer for my clients and partner for my clients, who took information, took opportunities, and put them in his own pocket. And what Judge Denton recognized is, due to all the evidence that he heard, including former agents of the Gaming Control Board, about what was going on and the technology that was involved and what happened, Judge Denton said 4 years in the market in which this gentleman had his way paid by the partnerships into the gaming industry was appropriate considering the long lead time it takes for this type of business to get up, operational, and be profitable. And Judge Denton said, I don't even have to address this argument about how, well, it could be anywhere in the world, because it wasn't anywhere in the world. It was in Nevada, which is where he was undertaking these improper activities against the interests of his own partners. So I'll be happy when we get on this back on the appeal, as Mr. Polsenberg says, at the end of the case, to be more than happy to talk about the record and the evidence that developed and Judge Denton's findings as the finder of fact about why he ruled that those restrictions were appropriate on the facts and circumstances of this case. But then the question becomes, if this was so dispositive, why did you wait until you lost that fundamental issue to seek a writ review? And I'll tell you why. Because that's not dispositive. And Judge Denton ruled that also when he denied summary judgment for me, or for my clients, and their clients on the 3-year statute of limitations. Judge Denton has already ruled, because some of the claims are unquestionably governed by a 3-year statute of limitations. He said that there is no summary judgment for either side because there are issues of fact about whether or not the 3-year statute of limitations has been implicated and whether or not the claims were timely brought. So if you were to intervene and decide this question, you know what it's going to resolve in terms of the merits of this case? Zero. It's going to resolve not a single claim in this case, which is why I had originally asked this court not to even spend its time intervening in this matter by way of writ petition. With all due respect, it is extremely disruptive to the district court proceedings to be entertaining a writ when, if it was so dispositive, don't you think that Mr. Asher and his counsel would have sought writ review rather than spend another year in litigation and another month in trial on the underlying merits if he really maintained that it was dispositive, that they were right on the law, the statute of limitations issue, and it was as dispositive as they're now trying to characterize to you? Of course they would have. This is an afterthought after they lost the first phase of the trial. And Judge Denton's 64 pages of findings are exactly why we're here now. It's not because of a summary judgment ruling that was entered a year before.
Mr. Bison,
yes.
Mr. Polsenberg asserts that we should look to Restatement 142 opposed to using 187, and you also cite to Tipton as to why we should.
Justice Douglas, let me explain why Judge Denton ruled the way he did and why he is right on this. And that is, this case, everything about this case happened in Nevada. The question before you is, what did the partnerships mean under Section 20.07 of the partnership agreements, which simply provide a general governing law provision that says that the agreement and the rights of the parties will be governed by and interpreted under Delaware law? That's all it says. It makes no reference to anything beyond that. There is no evidence that was presented to the district court creating any material issue of fact that provision somehow meant that we're really going to apply the Delaware statute of limitations on any claim brought anywhere against anybody for any events that they take. And that, by the way, is not just the law in Nevada. That's the law in Delaware, and that's the law in New York, the only jurisdictions whose laws are even implicated here. So you need to understand the sequence of events and who is all involved. The partnerships are Cantor Fitzgerald Limited Partnership, CFLP as it is called, Cantor G&W Nevada Holdings, which is a Cantor Gaming and Wagering Nevada Holdings. It is a Delaware limited partnership, but it was created to be a Nevada gaming entity, which it is. They then formed another Cantor Gaming and Wagering, Cantor G&W Nevada, which is a Nevada limited partnership and governed by Nevada law. Now, Mr. Asher acquires his interest in Cantor G&W Holdings, the Delaware limited partnership. He acquires his units, his ownership interest, by way of a subscription agreement, which is governed by New York law and has a New York choice of law provision in it. And as Judge Denton pointed out in his lengthy findings of fact and conclusions of law, it's that subscription agreement where Mr. Asher makes all the representations about his acknowledgement that the partnership agreement is enforceable and his acknowledgement that he has read it and his acknowledgement that he is going to abide by it. So when you understand the jurisdictions that are implicated here, you then step back and look at where did the events occur that give rise to the Kings. Mr. Asher is a Nevada resident. He was residing here in Nevada. All the activities that he undertook in this case occurred in Nevada. We had, I believe, more than a dozen witnesses at the first phase of trial. Every one of them is a Nevada resident because everything that occurred in this case that gives rise to his liability occurred in Nevada and took place in Nevada. My client's position is he stole the items in Nevada and he sold them to another Nevada entity. That brings us to the question is, where in this record, Justices, is there any evidence that the parties agreed or the partnerships agreed that Delaware statute of limitations would apply to wrongdoing and misconduct that was occurring in another state? And the answer to that is nowhere. There is no evidence of that. And in fact, the agreement provides the exact opposite. Section 20.01 of the partnership agreements specifically state that the partners have the choice of where to file suit against a partner for misconduct. They can file it in Delaware, they can file it in New York, or they can file it in the state in which the partner engages in wrongdoing. That is spelled out right in Section 20.01 of the partnership agreements. Contrary to the assertions that are made, these partnerships did not agree that Delaware law would somehow control the entire universe or agree to exclusive jurisdiction or venue in Delaware, that somehow Delaware's statute of limitations, Delaware's rules on punitive damages, Delaware's rules on damages, or the like, would somehow apply. To the contrary, Mr. Asher agreed when he subscribed to the partnerships pursuant to that New York subscription agreement. He agreed that the partnerships could sue him in New York, Delaware, or where he was working, which in this case was Nevada. And that is exactly why the partnerships filed suit here in Nevada. And those partnerships are entitled to enforce Nevada law concerning misconduct that occurred in Nevada. And that includes the Nevada statute of limitations.
What about, Mr. Polzberg made the argument under federal law that the statute of limitations is considered a substantive right versus a procedural right. You have any comment on that?
I do, Justice Gibbons. And actually, we point this out, and what the actual federal law is, what Mr. Polzberg is referencing is Erie principles concerning when you have whose law should govern for Erie purposes. That's fundamentally different, and we cite this in our brief, and it is at pages, my apologies, I want to just double check. I believe it is page 17 of our brief, which sets out the federal choice of law provisions and what the federal courts have consistently said, and the U.S. Supreme Court said it back in 1987, is that statutes of limitations are procedural for choice of law provisions, including contractual choice of law provisions. And in fact, we cite case after case, and we chronicle, I don't know how many states we have chronicled, where the state and the federal courts in all those states have pointed out that contrary to the argument that is being made, choice of law provisions, a standard choice of law provision, does not include the state statute of limitations, because those are deemed to be the sovereignty of the state, because those just simply determine when is the case too stale for our courts to consider it. That's what a statute of limitations is about. Those are purely a matter of legislative grace. The legislature purely decides what those are. Some states say it's 6 years, some states say it's 3 years, some states say it's 2 years. The point being, choice of law provisions do not include the statute of limitations, and we cite almost every jurisdiction holds that, except for really four, maybe five. So what has been sold to this court as a majority view is the exact opposite. There are a minority of courts, California, Florida, Massachusetts, Arizona, and I apologize, the last one is escaping me, that have held that we're going to take the position that a choice of law provision is deemed to include that foreign state statute of limitations.
But they acknowledge, and the California courts acknowledge this, that's not what most states do. In fact, most states do the exact opposite, and we chronicle them. And this court has also done that. This court has said that, because this court has made repeatedly the observation, both in the Friedman decision and the Ernest Hahn decision back in 1997, the statutes of limitations are deemed to be procedural bars to cases. And in the Tipton decision in 1993, this court said, even with a choice of law provision, those sorts of procedural questions are governed by the law of the chosen forum. And in this particular case, Mr. Asher expressly agreed that the partners could proceed against him in the state of Nevada. That was expressly agreed in the partnership agreements. And it's not just Nevada law. It's Delaware law as well. The Delaware courts have made it clear repeatedly, since 1961 until the most recent being in 2012, have said contractual choice of law provisions do not include the statute of limitations unless the parties expressly bargain for it. And this is where Mr. Polsenberg and I agree. Parties can expressly bargain for a different statute of limitations than the forum of law. They can make them shorter. They can make them longer. They can even bargain for the application of a particular state's laws if they want to on the statute of limitations. But as the Delaware courts have said, you just have to do it expressly. And if you don't do it expressly, that's your problem. And in this particular case, as the choice of law provision says, there is no such agreement. And the only other state's laws who are implicated here in New York holds the exact same way as the Delaware courts and have said repeatedly, a choice of law provision in a contract does not include the statute of limitations. If you want to include the statute of limitations, you must do so explicitly. And you can do that. That brings us back to this point. Where is the evidence in this record? Mr. Asher opposed our motion for summary judgment, which he lost. He presented no evidence whatsoever that the parties had a contrary intent. When this agreement was entered into in Delaware, under Delaware law, there was no evidence of a contrary intent other than what Delaware law had always provided. And that is that a choice of law provision does not include the statute of limitations. Nevada has followed that rule ever since. And with the 30 seconds I have left, I would make this point. What they are asking, what Asher is asking you to do, is wholesale, fundamentally alter Nevada law. You're being asked to basically alter the statute of limitations that has existed in this state for more than a century. And you're being asked to wipe that out in favor of just any contract that contains a choice of law provision now will somehow extrapolate in a foreign state statute of limitations, which has never been the law in this state, cuts off claims from other parties. And I see that I'm out of time, and I thank the court for its time.
Thank you. Mr. Polsenberg, as you come forward, would you begin with responding to the last portion of Mr. Bice's argument as to...
Mr. Bice says this has never been the law of Nevada, and I say nothing has ever been the law of Nevada on this point except for the Mardian decision. Here we're talking about a contract, and you can see why I don't want to go through a real trial with lawyers and parties on the other side. They're in here talking about 30 days, and there was never any evidence of a contrary intent. We don't have in contracts evidence of intent. This court said in Hotel Riviera Inc. versus Torres, it doesn't mean that two parties meant the same thing. It's that they said the same thing. It should be the law. Wilcox versus Williams should not be the law when it comes to contracts. It should be the law that when the parties agree that the law of another state applies, that should include the statute of limitations. And the restatement section, I don't think Mr. Bice ever answered your question about section 142 and 187. 142 applies when you don't have a contract. 187 applies when you do have a contract. And what 187 says is that the law, any law you agree to apply, so long as it's something of a subject matter that you could have expressly agreed to it. Mr. Bice says we could have agreed to a limitations period. The fact that we could have agreed to it means that it is part of the contract under 187.
Would you disagree with Mr. Bice's position that looking at the contract that was agreed to and accepting Delaware law as a cornerstone, we come to the same spot here or not.
No, we don't. Juron versus Braun, the case that they rely on, is a case that mentioned the issue and then went on to decide that the case, the action was brought in equity. So it didn't even apply the principle. What this court needs to do is not decide what would be the choice of law principle that Delaware would use. This court has to apply its own choice of law principle. And we don't know what Delaware would do. I pointed it out in my opening brief that it is an open question in Delaware, and yet in their answering brief, they continue to persist on citing the Juron versus Braun case. But there's a more important provision here. Remember, their argument is based on the idea that there's a substantive procedural distinction. And that is gone in the law, so you shouldn't have to expressly mention the statute of limitations. But this provision went further. First of all, it said the agreement and the rights. So it's not just the agreement, it's also the rights of the parties to bring action are governed by Delaware law without regard to principles of conflicts of laws. And that means we don't look to whether it's substantive or procedural.
Give us your concluding thoughts since we took some of your time.
This is a very important issue, and this is a very simple issue, and it's an issue of law as much as they want to make it an issue of fact. I think it's an important issue this court should finally decide. Mardian came close. Mardian reached the right result. Mardian should be the law in this context, and I think that it was intuitive that that should be the law. I think the en banc court should address this is a critical issue that comes up all the time, and I hope the court will address it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank both counsel for their arguments as of this particular matter this day. This matter will stand submitted at this time.